Today is Friday, June the 19th, 2015. I'm interviewing Mr. Ted Hill, formerly of Summercoats Farm, the end of Percival Road. Ted will give us some thoughts about the life and times of his family, starting back where they came from.
Thank you, Frank. Well, as Frank has said, my name is Ted, Edward in fact, but known as Ted Hill. I've lived in Percival Road all my life, which is now a fair while considering. I'm 83 years old now, or close to it, and I hopefully will see a few years yet. Obviously, in that length of time, the situation here has changed a great deal, and I've no doubt we can discuss that a little bit later. As far as myself and family are concerned, my forebears basically came here. My father's family were ex-Nelson. They arrived in Nelson in 1848 on a boat called, I believe, the Thomas Harrison. And from what I gather, the conditions at the time were fairly Spartan. But the family seemed to survive there for a period of time. There was quite a few of my uncles there. My mother's side of the family actually started off their time in Christchurch, Ashburton area. My grandmother on my mother's side arrived out on a boat from England, I believe, to be a governess. She was a girl of about 18 or 19, I believe. And she arrived out to be a governess, I think, for, I believe, the Grigg family, who were fairly well known in the district at that time. She married down there and they produced a family of, I think, 12 or 13. That's the Lowe family. And over the years, or fairly soon, many of the brothers and sisters actually emigrated north to the North Island, firstly up from Tynwald out of Ashburton, up towards the North Island to Foxton, Palmerston, and into Hawke's Bay here. I'm not quite sure how my mother and father met, but it was in the Hawke's Bay area here. Mother was, as I say, one of 12 or 13, and my father was one of also, I think, about 12. So families were fairly big in those days, and I'm talking prior to the turn of the century, or the second century.
Yeah. Ted, where did your grandparents come from by boat?
My paternal grandparents, I believe, came from Lincolnshire, and the Lincolnshire is reflected in the name of the farm that my mother gave the farm here, Summercoats, which was a rather a difficult name in the sense that most people called it Summercoats, whereas the actual spelling finally was C-O-T-E-S, not C-O-A-T-E-S, and that was, as you can imagine, a fairly common mistake. But Summercoats was the name given to the farm by my mother, and that company, the actual farming company, existed up until a very short time ago, until we actually liquidated it, because its usefulness to me was no longer. That was where the Summercoats name came from, and the actual company was inaugurated, or whether that's the right term or not, but it actually was evolved in 1955. I was probably about 23 or something like that at the time, and my mother and myself were the shareholders of Summercoats Farm. My mother held 90% of the shares and I held 10. That was the setup of the farm at the time. Prior to my being born, which happened fairly late in my mother's life, she, I think, was 44 when I was born, and she already had my brothers and sisters, namely my sister Ruth, who was the eldest, my brother Greg, who was the next, my sister Barbara, who was the third, my sister Helen was the fourth, and I came up as fifth in the family, as it were, a good, I think, about 15 or 16 years, the junior of my youngest sister, of my closest sister. Mm. And it made me very much an afterthought, you might say, in the family. The consequence of that was that I became the actual, because my mother was the youngest of her family, and I was her youngest sibling, it made me very much the youngest of the grandchildren. And I actually turned out to be the 74th, I believe. It was either 73rd or 74th. And ironically enough, the two below me are still in Hastings and still around, and we see a lot of one another. By the name of Tom Lowe, who was the, if I was the 74th, he was the 72nd, and Reuben Lowe was the 73rd. And we still are in close conversation, you might say, sure, in the local district. As such, that stretched over a fairly long period of time.
What was it like growing up in Twyford?
Well, it's funny you should say Twyford, because Percival Road here was a bit of a no man's land in that sense. We were known as Mahora at the time. Okay. It was part of the Mahora settlement, and this was known as Mahora. And in actual fact, Evenden Road, which is now the through road to the expressway, actually stopped at, it turned the corner at Percival Road, which we know now as Percival Road, and came down to our home and farm, with Bridgman's as the first house on the left-hand side you came up. In fact, the only house.
What was it like going to school and...
Well, Evenden Road, as I said, in the first instance, actually used to stop at the end of Percival Road and turn the corner in what is now Percival Road down to the farm. It wasn't until, I think it was the very early 30s, that Evenden Road was actually pushed through to meet up with Ormond Road, and because of the fact that there were different landholders in the way, that was why the kink which there is in Evenden Road at the end of Percival Road, and it still exists, that the land that was taken for the road actually came from what was the Bridgman farm on the way through to Ormond Road. At that time, in my school days, Evenden Road was just obviously a shingle road, and I don't know, we never noticed, it was just normal, I suppose, it was just shingle, and you put up with it to go to school. When I first went to school, which was at Mahora School, we went to Mahora School, my two sisters, who were employed in various places in Hastings at the time, when I was a very small infant child, you might say, they used to drop me off at school from their bikes till I got to, I don't know, Primary 3 or 4 or whatever it might have been, and then I had a bike of my own. Coming home in those days from school, before I had my own bicycle, I used to quite often get a ride up Evenden Road with the bread cart. They used to be a bread delivery with a horse and cart. How it worked, I've got now really no idea, but I distinctly remember the riding on the grey or the cart that was carrying the bread. And quite often, the bread in those days used to have a twist on it, twist on the top, and somehow or other, sometimes the bread got a bit burrowed into the fresh bread.
Now, that's interesting. You say you came up Evenden Road. Did you never have access through Lyndhurst Road?
The farm itself had access through to Lyndhurst Road. In my sister's and brother's time, there was not access through. The access through to Lyndhurst Road from our farm only came with the acquisition of what I believe was, my father bought an area of land down on the end of Lyndhurst Road, which adjoined our back, and then we then had access through to Lyndhurst Road.
So in the meantime, you had to do this big...
That's right.
...dog leg to go to school.
In effect, yes. Although, at times, we used to cut straight, not often, but where that hole in the hedge is right now, yes, we used to go straight through over there.
Was that Mahora Stud beyond?
That's Mahora Stud. It wasn't Mahora Stud then, although the Mahora Stud came into being about the last of the war, during the war year, and that was the Breen's property.
Right.
In fact, there was the Breen's property on Lyndhurst Road, and there was the Breen's property on Evenden Road, and looking where that hole is, the joint was just right there.
So when you finished at Mahora, you went to high school?
Yes, obviously then it was the combined boys and girls high school.
Yes.
Now, I think I did 2 years there. I think it was two, I didn't get far. My services were needed, apparently, back on the farm, and that's where I came to.
So you went to school. Did you play any sports at all, or...?
Not a great deal, to be frank. Our occupation in the farming scene tended to preclude too many sports in that sense. Most of the summer was occupied with the activities that were necessary on the farm. Yes. And the sporting activities weren't in vogue in those days.
Coming back to the farm, how big was the farm those days when you left school? How big was it, and then what was the family growing on it?
Well, the farm here, my father bought his original farm here about 1900, or might have been a bit before that, and it was a 45-acre block. I don't know for why, but much of the Mahora area here was surveyed at the time either into approximately 45-acre blocks, or 33 or 66-acre blocks.
They would have bought off another family, Williams or someone else on this side, wouldn't they?
Well, what happened here was Father bought the original 45-acre block, and then he bought the extension that went through to Lyndhurst Road from the Sinclair family, and I believe that was about 30 acres. And it made, on this side of the road, you might say, it made an area of 74 or 75 acres. And at the same time, and I'm not sure whether it was before or after, but we also acquired another 45-acre block, which was adjacent on the south side of the east side, you might say. And it created a small problem, to the extent that at the time, the law of the land was that if you had a government block, you couldn't hold another one. And the family or the solicitors, whoever it was, got over that problem by actually putting the 45-acre block, which was to be acquired, in the name of my eldest sister, Emily Ruth Hill. And it was one of those subterfuges, perhaps you could say, that happened and probably still happen. And the consequence of that was that increased the farm area to somewhere around, 125 acres or something like that. Mm. And that block was farmed in conjunction with, because they were adjoining, it was all farmed as one. And in those days, and I'm talking about the war years and immediately after the war, the major operation was growing ryegrass seed. In the summer was the ryegrass seed production, usually combined with 8 or 10 or 12 acres of potatoes. Yes. as a ground crop. Mm-hmm. And the farm ran stock, sheep, generally sheep, during the winter. Mm-hmm. And that was the pattern of the farming operation until the advent of the pea industry.
Well, just coming back to the ryegrass industry, those would be the days of mainly horses, were they?
Yes, yes. Horses, sledge, traction engine, and Clayton and Shuttleworth stationary mill. It was taken from paddock to paddock.
And, of course, the big stacks of ryegrass that was...
The stacks were usually either stacked, and very often, in my day, anyhow, I don't know whether it happened earlier on, because I don't know when baling first started, but very often the stacks were converted into bales via Eric Batson. He used to take his baler around the various stacks, and the stacks were converted into bales.
Potatoes, that would have all been done with horses too, wouldn't it?
Yes, it was, but I personally didn't actually ever have a horse trained. At the time I started, basically about in 1947 or 48, I think it was, Ferguson tractors started to come into play. The Ferguson tractor arrived, and that, well, I wouldn't say it revolutionised the job. It went a long way towards
it. It certainly changed things.
Yes. Scarifying and moulding up potato rows became a different proposition.
Yes. Then as the farm developed, you obviously had a major part in the running of it.
Yes. We originally ran the farm for a period of time as a joint operation between, it was called AE and AG Hill. That was my elder brother, my only brother, I should say. And that persisted for a few years, but it finally drifted apart to the extent that he started to run his own. He acquired the 45 acres from my sister, who had it in her name at that time. It was sold to him, my brother, along with a small 7-acre block on which he built a house, and that fronted onto Lyndhurst Road and adjoined onto the back of the 45-acre block.
So then the farm progressed into growing other crops. You mentioned peas, and so would you like to develop that?
Well, we grew our first peas in 1948. Only a small area of, I think it was 5 acres, or it might have been 10, but I think it was 5. And Waddy's at that time were just entering into the harvesting business of, they were just giving up hand-picking pod, and the crop was handled with a mower and a rake and loaded onto trucks and carted to the factory for vining to extract the leaves. Now, obviously, over the next decade or two, that became very much more refined in terms of the way they did it. And we, you know, refined our farming operations in like manner.
Yes. And, of course, with the peas, there were beans that were hand-harvested.
That's right.
In the paddock with pickers, yeah, and their big bags. And
my wife hasn't got such fond memories of that, and as much as it was her job to pay this myriad of pickers. And it was my job, basically, to try to keep them from kicking the bottom of the tin and filling it up with dirt and one thing and another. And an interesting, to me anyhow, part of that story was that I was not at all convinced that picking beans by hand and having the problems of the labour requirements and the fact that they would go off comparatively quickly and they needed to be harvested, picked at a certain point in time, and you couldn't plant more than a few acres at a time because you just simply didn't have the manpower simply to pick the quantity that you would like. And I was very, very keen on the question of mechanical harvesting of beans. And I made representations over a period of time, a long period of time really, to the factories to keep an eye on the developments that were happening, particularly in America, with bean-picking machines. And I don't know whether I'd be perfectly true in saying, but I think I was a major instigator in persuading the factory to buy the first Chisholm Ryder harvester that they bought to, sure, eliminate hand picking, yes, beans. And yes, I think from memory that was in 1960.
Yeah, it probably would be, because hand picking just disappeared like that. As soon as the machine, yeah, came in, no one wanted to hand pick anymore. But you still could only harvest so much a day, couldn't you?
Oh, yeah.
And the plantings had to be staged.
You had, yes, to stagger them. But the machine harvesting, of course, got rid of the problem of the hand-picking that was unsustainable, really.
So then the peas, of course, were being harvested and the vines taken to the cannery to be thrashed by static mills. You would have then been part of the static mills. They put on these big trailers and went out to the paddocks and harvested them in the, yeah, paddocks.
In the first instance, that was Wilson Hazelwood, Tom Ryan and Webbs. And I've got a feeling that Wilson Hazelwood actually was probably the first to actually put one on wheels. Mm. And then came the succession of different types of pickers that the Americans were experimenting with and putting into production. And they all, well, right to this present day, there's simply a development going on with them.
Yeah, so that was a really wonderful story. The pea harvesters and the way that they could harvest peas that were so young without damaging them. Then you would have entered into the tomato industry.
Yes.
Picking into boxes. Remember those days?
I remember them only too well. Broken back picking 60-pound cases of
tomatoes. That's probably why your back's still, yeah, sore from them.
Yeah.
So when you started growing
piles
tomatoes,
of bins, right, piles of boxes. The boxes were basically, you put them into bunches of three. One in the bottom, one put in long ways in the middle,
right,
and the other one over the top. You had three empty cases and you dumped them up the rows off your trailer. And then when they were harvested by hand, you had the problem of going along and picking them up and loading them on a trailer and, yes, then loading them on a truck.
So how many acres worth of tomatoes were you growing during the hand picking?
Probably about 10 or 20.
That was a lot for hand harvest.
Oh, absolutely. Break-breaking.
And so as time went on, you were part of the development of mechanical harvesting of tomatoes, the bulking of them, but also...
Well, the first thing that was the biggest help, and it's still probably the major factor involved in a lot of that, and that was the advent of a forklift.
Oh, absolutely.
The forklifts, I don't know about whether they revolutionised anything, but they simply made the operation possible.
Yes, they certainly did.
And there were a fair variety of forklifts introduced in those days. People had their own ideas as to how they should be and what they shouldn't be, and one thing and another, but anything that lifted something and put it up in the air was of a huge moment.
And of course, all the sprays we were using on the crops then were not as sophisticated as they are now.
They were probably reasonably sophisticated in those days, but today you wouldn't be allowed to use 90% of them. They'd be off the list.
Of course, those days when you were growing Scoresby tomatoes.
That's right.
Because the Scoresby tomato,
it was about a foot in diameter.
It was a soft fruit. Yeah. It didn't keep it, so it needed the copper sprays to keep the fungus out. And then, I guess, when we went to machine harvesting, we went to the Italian-style tomato, didn't we?
Yeah, or the harder skin.
Yes.
The same thing happened, of course, with the beans. The original beans were the green beans I'm talking about. The varieties that were used then weren't really suitable for a machine pick. And the machine picking went hand in hand, you might say, with the variety escalations of the types that were being bred specifically for it. Actually, the question of the beans was quite interesting from our point of view. We grew quite a considerable acreage of peas, and we discovered that with the advent of irrigation, that if you got your peas out early enough, you could follow it with the copper beans, which actually suited us, and it suited the factory too, because they were spreading their load also, as it were, the processing load. And when the machine harvesting of green beans started to come in, when it first came in, I can still remember the invitation that Watties issued for growers to come to the factory and talk about the possibilities of what this green bean harvester was going to be, and as growers, what we thought we would be doing. And as I said before, I was always, you know, keen on the question of mechanical things and mechanical doing things, and I hated this hand-picking deal. And I thought, well, if I can get away from that, I will be. But the downside of the machine situation, as it was explained to us at a huge growers meeting at Watty Hill, you may even recall it, I don't know, but Watty's held this meeting to discuss the question of the forthcoming mechanical harvesting of beans, and the downside was that the beans had to be planted in a 36 or even a 40-inch row, and we had been accustomed to planting them with a drill on every second coulter of the drill, which was actually made a 14-inch row. Right. And many said, oh, we'll never grow a crop by halving or more than halving the row widths. And one thing and another, and I thought, I don't know, I still don't like hand-picking. So Watties actually gave us the option of whether we would like to grow for machine or whether we would like to grow for hand-picking still, or a combination of both, in the sense that they said that you could hand-pick the first crop and then the first flowering of the crop, and then they would come in with the harvester and harvest the second, the lot. I said, no, not for me. I said, I'll go only machine-picking. And they said, at the end of the meeting, put down your preferences and how many acres you would like. But I put down on my piece of paper that I'd like 60 acres. And 60 acres was a huge quantity.
It certainly was.
And anyhow, it came out that many opted to go halfway to the both. Some stayed with the hand picking, and there wasn't a huge take up in the first instance because everybody thought, oh, the harvesting situation, it'll be a failure, it'll do this or that. Well, as it turned out, certainly the first year or two, the yields weren't all that flash because, you know, we're on a learning curve. But boy, oh boy, from my point of view, at the end of the day, that 60 acres of beans, I stuck to that over the years that followed, over many years that followed, and a year or two later when the machine harvesting really started to get going, everybody says, how on earth do you get 60? Because they were dishing it out in 5-acre lots. And in fact, to cover up to some extent my, I can't think of the word, but to conceal it to some extent, I shifted the the quantities between three different farm names. We had about 20 acres in each.
But I mean, you did come in at the beginning and say, yes, you'd have a go at full machine harvesting, so why shouldn't you?
Exactly. I tell you what, it was a very close-run thing, too, in the sense that at that time, you will recall the Watty Fire, well, that harvester for the... We were actually irrigating about 60 acres of beans out on the farm out here at the time that fire occurred. And the harvester had just arrived at the bloody place only a matter of a few weeks before. And we looked out there, and Jen, you know, verified. I went out the door to shift the irrigation. And I came back inside and said to Jean, look over here.
I hope the harvester's not in there.
Exactly that. Exactly that. As it so happened, it didn't.
But, so you had had peas in that?
I had peas prior.
And then
And of course that absolutely compounded the work all over the Christmas period. We transferred the grass seed problem into the body. Christmas was always just a...
But you also grew quite a lot of beet too, didn't you?
Well, that started just a year or so after that. Yes, we went into the beet in a big way. Well, for ourselves in that sense. It was a new crop for what is actually it's mentioned in those books.
So how many acres of beet did you
grow? Oh, we only started off, I think we had about 6 or 7 acres the first year.
It was quite a lot though, because it was close planted beet.
Well, all we did then, we didn't know anything about it much. All we did then was use Planet Juniors and just spilled it up the road. Then we got a whole heap of Indians from Fiji, that's right, and they sat on their bums with a knife thinning it out. And weeding it out up the road.
But first, Whitey's used a harvester first, didn't they?
Well, in the first instance there was, but...
And they would only harvest about an hour or two a day?
Anyhow, it wasn't long before we got... I was once again, you know, totally interested in the mechanical side of the thing, and we imported the buddy harvester from FMC and harvested our own.
Because Phil Baines had a harvester too.
That was after, yes. Phil and I used to work together quite a bit.
So at this point then, you met Jean?
No, we were already married at that time. We were married in 1958.
Okay, so Jean has been here for most of those growing.
Yes.
Of course you were taking morning tea out to the...
That was prior to our wedding.
And after our wedding.
So now just to bring the story up to date, where did you come from? Were you a local person, Jean?
Well, originally I came from England.
Are you English?
Yes, south of London. And in 1949, Mum and Dad decided that we would come to New Zealand. They thought that after the war there wasn't much for us younger ones. At first we were in a boarding house called Shortlands, which is on the Marine Parade, which is part of the museum now. It was right next door to what was the court. And then we got a place, Mum and Dad got a place at West Shore, where we lived there. And Dad bought a section in Onikawa, and he built our house. And our house was the third house to go up in the whole of Onikawa. And the first house to be built was built by the Hawke's Bay Electric Power Board. Anyhow, I worked at various places until I could get a job, what I was trained for as a shorthand typist.
You had left school when you came up?
Yes, I never went to school in New Zealand.
Right.
But I went to night school and took shorthand and English. And I worked at Tate Shoe Store. I worked in a hotel. I worked in a bar until I could get the job that I was trained for. And then I went and worked in the bank, and what was the Union Bank of Australia then, all hand posting. And then I became the manager's secretary, and then the machines came in, and I said, right, I want to learn those. So I did. Well, anyway, on the social side, I made several friends, obviously, and I took up ballroom dancing. And that's where I met Ted.
I see. Are you a bit of a whiz on the floor?
No, I was just I had two left feet.
Oh, you pretty good.
Do you know, it's amazing. A friend and I, Ken McEwen, who you wouldn't know,
Yes, we do.
You, Ken.
Yes.
Ken, well, it used to be at Dawn Road.
Yeah, well, yeah. Ken was my closest friend. We grew up together.
Oh, he died, did he?
He died of Parkinson's in, up in... it's between Whakatane and Tauranga.
Remind me to come back again to Killiquin.
And anyhow, I got up to gold in my exams and things, and Ted, he went up to silver. And anyway, then they wanted us to go away for competitions, and my parents wouldn't allow me to go. So what I did was I turned professional and I taught ballroom dance. And our teacher used to say, well, if I was so many years younger, the only guy that I would have was Ted. And I thought, gosh, I'm not going to look at him with a 10-foot barge pole. And anyhow,
the truth's coming out.
He asked me, oh, he knows all this. He asked me out to the Mahora School Jubilee Ball. And his sister and Greg, her husband.
That was in 1953.
Was the first time we ever went out together. But anyway, we didn't go out together again until the following year. And he asked me to go to the show. And then he took me home to his parents, to his mother. And they made me so welcome. But Ted and I, we went up on the piano because, too, I had done a bit of acting on the stage and done quite a bit of singing. And we had a lot of fun around the piano and whatever have you. And then our friendship just blossomed from there. And we were 3.5 years together. And then we got married in 1958, February 1958. And Ted said to me, now we get married in October and we go away for a week, or we get married in February and we can go away for a month. So I thought, right, we'll get married in February, then we can go down the South Island. I'd never been to the South Island. And I thought it would be many years before we could ever do that ever again. And that's what we did. But as the years went on, we found it difficult to even celebrate a wedding anniversary, never mind about preparing for a wedding, because our farming changed. But that was really brilliant.
So then during those years, you had how many children?
We had four, and the eldest was 4.5 when the baby was born. And during that time, bearing in mind, I didn't even have a calculator. There were no computers, no nothing. Mm. Everything was all done by hand. Our first taste was with beans of employing people. And I had to keep all the tallies and I had to do all the wages. And in those days, you had to pay them by cash. And so then I worked it all out and then worked all the pounds, shillings and pence out, took the cheque to the bank and got all the money, came home, had to put them all in little envelopes, go out to the paddock and they had to sign in the wages book. And then when we came to do tomatoes, and bearing in mind there were about 20, 30 people who were picking, and the same thing when we came to do tomatoes. And then it became easier. We were able to pay them by cheque, but they still had to sign a wages book. And then peach time, when we were doing peaches, you know, and I look back and I wonder how did I cope with doing all that, having four small children, feeding the men, and I did all the baking, and I made everything that the children wore except for singlets, underpants, socks and ties and shoes.
Okay, I'll revert back now to Ted.
We started growing beetroot in the first instance. It was a new crop for Watties and it required some development in the sense of you learnt as you went along. And I think we were probably preeminent in the area of growing it in the first instance. I actually imported the first precision planter for it. I was always poring over magazines for this and that in the farming world, and I saw advertised a firm in England called Stanhay, and they were involved in producing a so-called precision planter, and I thought, well, something that's got to be better than Planet Junior's just spilling seed down the road.
Right.
And I imported one through, somehow or other, I still don't know to this day why, but it came through Tourist Celt. They somehow seem to be the Tourist Celt and Farming Corporation and those things. And John Lake brought it out here in a box. He said, there it is. I don't know anything about it. We don't know anything about it. It's up to you. And I believe it was the first one to come to the country.
Yes, that would be right, because we used to have to get the Dutchman.
Phil
used to come and sow out.
Yes, well, actually, what happened there was Phil, the original one I bought was a 4-row one, planted 4 rows. Because with 4 rows under the tractor, you had to turn around and your wheel tracks went on one on the other. I thought, well, I'll get a 6-row one, and then I can run the tractor wheels up the centre of, and we can turn straight round. I haven't got this double. And I actually sold Phil my 4-row one, and I bought a 6-row. That was during the 60s that happened, more or less. And, of course, there are a lot more sophisticated ones out now, but the beetroot in those days was quite a steep learning curve. And I actually spent some time in America on a couple of occasions and in Australia looking at the operations over there as to how they handled their crop and how they did it. And I brought back several innovations to the factory here in relationship to beetroot, and we became reasonably preeminent in the production of it and the finish. I think actually towards the end of my growing days, the apertures had gone into it in a fair way, and the other two or three growers that were around had sort of, they'd stopped. Then finally, as I say, I think the apertures basically, very much later years now, apertures are basically the only growers.
Just coming back during your growing period, you became very active within the politics of vegetable growing in Hawke's Bay, and eventually this led to your involvement with the National Group.
Well, yes, well, you're right. We became involved in a political sense in relationship to the negotiations that we used to run with Waddies in terms of the prices and the conditions and so forth of supply that they would like. Overall, we had a very, comparatively amicable relationship with the factories. Of course, there were several factories originally in Hastings. There was Fropax, there was Birdseye, there was Waddies, of course. I think there was another outfit called Zero Pack from memory. There were several different processes.
Canes?
Well, they came a long way.
That's right, the later ones.
Yes. The politics of the growing situation, obviously, if you're interested, I got involved, and over the years I moved up, you might say, in the rank of who was what in terms of the vegetable growing industry. And I actually went through the chairs, you might say, of the process division, which was part of VegFed at the time. And then I became the actual Federation president, which incorporated the process and fresh market vegetables. And I had a fair bit to do with this dreaded term of amalgamation of the potato, I'm trying to think of what they called themselves, the main crop potato growers anyhow. There was the early growers who were part of VegFed, but there was the main crop growers who were growers in their own right, you might say.
Yes.
And there was several years of quite torturous negotiations went on before they were persuaded to become part of VegFed itself. And even then, amalgamation wasn't all that popular. It was quite an achievement.
Yes, so that obviously was quite rewarding. You probably wondered how you made time for it while you were
farm. Well, that's true. Mm. But, it's a bit like Topsy. These things grow on you as you go along. It's a bit different today. Much the same sort of situation applies, obviously, but I think, for better or worse, the positions now are such that there's more of a financial incentive, shall we say, to be able to do these things. When in those days, it was mostly on yourself. You did it yourself, and that was that.
Now, obviously, you were busy enough growing crops, but then you made a foray into Golden Queens.
The Queens actually arrived by inheritance, you might say. What happened basically was that my brother, who'd taken over the 45 or the 52 acres, had been adjacent part of the farm. He had decided that he was no longer going to be interested in that, and I negotiated to buy that part of the property from him. And in the meantime, he planted 30 acres of queens on it. And so I inherited the queens. And they lasted there for quite a few years, in fact, but as such, that was my introduction to fruit growing.
But you didn't grow any apples, did you?
No, I wasn't growing any apples at the time, although once again I inherited some apples when we bought the property here, which was next door again.
So when you sort of look back and think, you really covered the field with crops from ryegrass, potatoes, any other crops that...
Oh, we grew a major quantity of cauliflower here for Waddies, also for Waddies. We grew probably... In the heyday, 4 or 5 years, I suppose, we grew probably 40, 50 acres.
Did you?
Yeah, quantity. The harvesting was the biggest, but you had to go through them every day, every two or three days, otherwise they'd go to waste. Yeah. I don't know if you remember the hoatas. I used to have them here as a gang, walking up and down the buddy roads and catching cauliflowers. You ought to talk to Gene about it. A bit of a sad story in some ways, in as much as that in the first year or so that we grew, or it might have been the first year that we grew them. I think Waddies decided they didn't want to handle all the greenery in the factory, they didn't want the curds. And we'd harvest them and then spend the night cutting the bloody curds out and putting them. And the ironical part came in the disposal of the greenery. At that time, I had three house cows, and we were milking these three house cows because we had never had the services of a milkman, you see. So I threw these cauliflowers out to the bloody cows.
It killed them?
No, it didn't kill them, not then. There was another aspect of that, but it did kill the milk for a few days. Well, we got fairly involved in the tomato growing operation, the mechanical harvesting operation with Waddies, and that got fairly big in that Waddies, in their wisdom, decided that they wanted only a few growers and large areas, which, in retrospect, as far as we were concerned, was a failure. I don't know, we weren't really set up, I suppose you could say, with the way the factory wanted tomatoes and the harvesting operations and the weather factors. And there were several, 2 or 3 years in which we had droughts, and I think then we got wet weather in the harvest deal. And it was a learning curve from both Waddies, both of ourselves and the big growers, basically, that they wanted at the time. It was about the time when Heinz bought the factory, and the atmosphere, you know, changed over a period of a few years. And what was a negotiable situation between us and the factory, or between the growers, you know, became harder and harder. Mm. And, well, we basically gave up the large scale. And then in the process, we developed the nursery that Graham still has in growing the tomato plants, which is a better proposition from our point of view than the actual growing of the crops. So, and another factor was coming into it, and that was the question of the land supply. You couldn't find, these crops needed fresh land. And we had, over the years, perhaps unknowingly, we gave the ground a hard time.
You mentioned Graham growing plants, so he's still actively growing plants?
Yes, he still actively grows all Waddies tomatoes. That's in the greenhouses down the bottom there. Over the years, it's going down in terms of quantity. Waddies import a great deal of their production now is imported via paste. Where they use the crop at the present time mainly for is in their diced tomatoes and that sort of thing that they can't reconstitute out of paste.
So what else can you think of? Obviously, when you look back on your growing life, Ted, you've seen some wonderful changes. You know, tonnages, you've seen change in chemicals, fertiliser, all sorts of things. You've come through a very interesting phase of the growing industry, haven't you?
Well, that's unquestionable, and the changes are still going on, but the way... Nostalgically, the way I look at it is that I think that the best years were those 70s and the early 80s when we were dealing with a firm in Hastings that we knew, they knew us, and everything went ahead reasonably smoothly as far as the weather and other factors like that were concerned. And we didn't have a lot of the problems that are involved today with consents for this and consents for that, and difficulties with burning, for instance, smoke, and all this sort of, and the health and safety factors that are so prevalent today. I'm not saying it's not all important today, but the fact is that in those days, we didn't even appreciate. a lot of the things that are necessary today.
Right.
And it just makes it that much harder. Mm. And I believe that from where I sit, I'm not sorry that we're not in it in that sense now. Those were the good days. And the days now are simply dictated by factory requirements, and there's not much deviation in that sense.
So you're now working from this home here. How much land's attached to this?
Oh, came the mid-90s, or might have been before that, I rightly or wrongly decided we'd been acquiring land. We acquired more around in Everton Road over the years and so forth, but I decided that if the family were interested, they could take over the properties, and we in effect divided the farm up between the three boys. And for better or worse, for one reason or another, all three now are, apart from Graham's interest in growing the tomato plants, they have all disposed of their interests, yes, the land and their interests. And all that I'm personally left with is the area, our own house area. And at our age, it's quite enough.
So the Golden Queen block went too?
Yes, yes. Douglas had that, but he sold parts of that off bit by bit, and that's all now gone in that respect. And Michael sold the old. We moved here from our own original home so that Michael could take it over with the land that he acquired as far as the property division between the boys was concerned. But that's now all gone into the park.
Yes.
And frankly, as far as the way we look at it now, I'd just as soon see it in the park. I'd rather see it in the park, quite frankly, than to see a lot of development going over it and houses and so forth. Whether that would become or not, it probably would have, but it's now in the park and I don't think that'll ever alter.
You're children, you still have Graham who grows
Douglas is now, since he sold the last of his part of what was the farm, he is now working for Waterforce, and he's a very good engineer, and he worked here for a period of time doing some fairly substantial engineering in relationship to irrigation and water for crops and grapes and so forth. Graham, his occupation is the nurseryman, growing these plants, and a lot of other plants as well he grows for various other clients. He's actually grown quite a few trees for works department, putting along the sides of the roads, these sort of things.
Yeah.
He's still got a portion of it up there. Michael, well, his area that was he had here is now in the park, and he's got a job. He is also an engineer, and he's doing his engineering in the apple industry, basically. And the daughter, Jane, who was the second child, she's married to an individual in Palmerston North, and they've got five children, and we've got about 10 or 11 great-grandchildren.
So the Hill name still lives on.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. So you brought your children up. They've all flown the nest. They're all busy doing their own thing. I notice that you are a JP, but you also...
I've got a Queen's Honour.
Have you had any civic awards? Or
not to my knowledge.
So, Jean, you're a JP plus... A marriage celebrant?
Yes, yes.
Over the years, I know she worked very, very hard for a political party. Very, very hard. We all did.
And we had a lot of fun doing, towards the end, yes, but still.
So anyway, obviously, you're still involved. Were you in the hospital?
Yes, I was on the hospital board. Yeah.
Can you just develop some of those things? Because that really makes the family...
Well... During the time that the family were growing up, I was able, and Ted encouraged me, to continue my acting and singing, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And then I've been very involved in the Women's Division Federated Farmers and got life awards and all the rest of the drama, and really concentrated on health, education and law. And then I was made a JP and I was invited to take exams to be able to sit on the bench, which I did for about 12 years, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Felt very sorry for some aspects, but I did enjoy my time on there. But I've been retired because I've passed the age. And I'm a marriage celebrant and I've done a number of weddings. and I wouldn't like to say how many I've done. Been doing it since 89, and we have weddings in our garden. Only unfortunately, when some of my prospective clients see my garden, they're please can we come and have our photos taken after the ceremony. So that's what they do. And I'm also involved in a smaller way in mental health, but I've wound down a lot to what I did do. And last year I joined a group, Bell Chimes, and we go out giving concerts to different organisations. Yes, sure. And I thoroughly enjoy that. Yeah. But all through that, yes, for our farming operation and whatever, I've always kept the books. And I'm not an accountant, so the accountant finishes those off. We've been married for 57 years. And on the whole, we have had a very happy marriage.
Well, you've both been great contributors to the community as a grower and as a wife, mother, and your input in various organisations. And, you know, that really is a very balanced life, isn't it?
It
is. You wonder how you ever had time to do it, but they say, if you've got something to do, find a busy person, because they'll do it.
Yes, well, Ted was involved in the Scouts and used to go away with Scout groups one form or another. And I was involved in Scouts too.
Yes.
And in our earlier years, we were involved in the Hawke's Bay Car Club. And we gave that up because it was too stressful when you've got little children. And it wasn't fair to be hawking them around. Mm. And so we gave that up.
We managed then to do a bit of jet boating, a bit of whitewater rafting over the years.
Well, Ted's done a lot of rafting. I've only done two or three trips. But he has done some quite heavy grey rafting. Mm. He's even been down the South Island and done. But they did jet boating for about 18 years, and while I was never involved in driving or anything, I was involved in organising. And way back, there used to be about 10 or 12 jet boats which would leave from Hawke's Bay here, and I used to do all the organising for all the motels and everything all the way around. And in those days, gosh, the poor beggars, you know, there was no talk of wetsuits or anything in those days, and they just had to wear ordinary clothes.
They were tough.
Yes, but my challenge was to get them dry for the next day. And in those days, even motels didn't have laundries and that sort of thing. And it was very difficult getting things dry. Mm. And I remember over in the West Coast,
we
only had a potbelly stove, you know. Yes, but they had to be dry and warm when they first started. But then as the years went on, of course, they had wetsuits, so it didn't involve a lot of drying.
The whole scene, though, has changed now. It's got obviously a lot more safety orientated, and there's a lot more form filling in. You can't just go where you want. Our brown brothers have a major say as to whether this is available or not.
But all the same, when we were doing the jet boating, we had a lot of fun.
We met
a lot of lovely people.
Oh, yes.
We even went to Canada one time.
Yes.
And, no, it was good.
Well, one final question. Did you ever border onto the Ballantyne property?
No.
It was always a property between.
Quite a lot. It's quite a long way between Lyndhurst Road and the Ballantyne. Yes.
Didn't the Ballantyne property come
came,
up there?
It came quite a way up, but... but it never came past, to my memory, it didn't ever come past Ikenui Road.
No,
it was always the other orchards that were in there. Stony Cross came up, I think, as far as Ikenui Road.
Well, Bixley's orchard.
Yeah, there was several. When you come down to Arbuckle Road and Ikenui Road, there was a lot of... One of my uncles was the George Lowe orchard there, which is now on the corner of the new road, the roundabout, where Nottingham Road. That was another uncle. Reuben Lowe actually ran that orchard for a while. He leased it there from his uncle family. They were dead then, but there was, as I say, there were all those orchards and small holdings all the way through there.
I realised all you people were related.
Oh, yeah. I was going to actually mention going to the school. The Marden household was the one around the corner here where all the cars...
All those cars that are there now? Now, something Ted didn't tell you when he was a little fellow, he would leave his home properly attired with a raincoat and shoes and socks. And at the Marden household down there, because that was Mother's sister's home, he used to take his shoes and socks and raincoat and stuff them in the hedge and pick them up on the way home.
I wonder he didn't need dry clothes when he was jet boating.
There was the bowler and all the other rubbish that came along, and interest rates soared and production went down. There were a lot of farmers who were really in a distressed situation, and a lot of them were suicidal. And in fact, some of them actually committed suicide. Now, there was one particular bank that was the first to put them into liquidation, and that would be the ANZ. And the other banks were little more tolerant. And the different coordinators that we worked with, we were very careful who we selected, because they not only had to have some farming background of one sort or another, but they had to have empathy with people, because farmers by their nature are very isolated people and clamour and say everything's fine. So if you had a person who you felt that you could talk to and trust, they could open up and you could help them. And we did. We've helped a lot of farms. Then we had another one, but then it got changed again. And after about 14 years, well, it just, as far as the old committee was concerned, we just got disbanded.
We thought that in the earlier 80s and the 70s were the good old days.
Max Mart, who bought my orchard, said that when they bought Mangarapa Station, him and his brother, they had no money at all. They went out there with a couple of bulldozers and a lot of hope. And he said, they struck the 1951 ball boom. He said, timing.